Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All lines are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer sessions. At that time, please press star one and record your name as prompted. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn today's meeting over to Casey Reeves. Thank you. You may begin.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for taking the time today to join us. I'm gonna cover the welcome and ground rules and introductions, and hopefully we can get through this in a timely manner. I want to just go over a couple of ground rules. Please raise your hand for commenting or enter comments into chat. The framework for today is to maintain BOEM's open process with stakeholders to engage and make sure we have timely updates on the projects and process and efforts that are occurring in the region. This is our second intergovernmental Virginia and North Carolina task force. And the framework of today is going to be largely based on updates from developers and the states of North and South Carolina, or I'm sorry, North Carolina and Virginia, on the projects that are occurring off the coast. We have a great list of speakers today, and we're happy to be joined this morning by several agencies, and I'd ask you to remember to please mute your phone when you're not talking. If anyone has joined us in Adobe, we have a phone line set up that is in the chat box below. With that being said, we're going to go around here, I think, in the room and get through introductions, and then I'll go over the agenda for today. We'll go around with BOEM agency representatives first here in the room. You have myself, Casey Reeves, and I'm the Virginia State Lead in the Projects and Coordination Branch for BOEM.
This is Will Watkins. I'm with BOEM. I work with Casey. I am the BOEM's point of contact for the state of North Carolina, as well as the project coordinator for Avangrid Fleet that you'll hear about later today.
Hi, I'm Michelle Warren. I'm the Chief of BOEM's Environment Branch for Renewable Energy.
Hi, this is Jim Bennett. I'm the Program Manager for Offshore Renewables here in the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management.
Good morning. This is Dave McDuffie. I'm the Chief of our Projects and Coordination Branch.
Stephen Batwell, and I work in BOEM's Office of Public Affairs.
Good morning. This is Al Jean Byrne with BOEM, Environmental Protection Specialist.
This is Leanne Fullen. I work in the Office of Renewable Energy Program.
Richard Warner. I'm a cultural resource specialist, archaeologist, and visual impact assessment.
Daryl Francois, Chief of Engineering and Technical Review.
Mary Bowman, Science Coordinator for the Renewable Energy Program.
Okay, and who else do we have on the line from BOEM?
Hi, this is Jen Bukatari. I am the Environmental Coordinator for North Carolina.
Hi, this is Monty Kemiki. I'm a Renewable Energy Program Specialist in the Engineering and Technical Review Branch.
Okay, hearing no one else, I want to mention that BOEM's task force membership is made up of federal agencies, elected tribal and government, elected local and elected state officials, and representatives from those agencies. We'll ask yourself to please announce yourselves now, and I'll try to do it in an orderly fashion. Let's start with, do we have any members of elected tribal governments joining us this morning? Anyone from the Army Corps of Engineers? Fish and Wildlife Service?
Good morning. This is John Stanton. I'm with the Southeast Region of Fish and Wildlife Service, Division of Migratory Bird Management.
Welcome, John. Anyone else from Fish and Wildlife Service? NOAA?
Case Wilbur, NOAA Fisheries.
Candace Snackman, NOAA Fisheries.
Sue Tuxbury, NOAA Fisheries.
Welcome. The Navy.
Yeah, Casey, Jim Casey here at Fleet Forces in Norfolk.
Department of Defense. Department of Homeland Security. All right, U.S. Coast Guard.
Good morning, Matt Krillman from the 5th Coast Guard District.
Morning, Matt. And we're from the Environmental Protection Agency.
This is Kelly Fortin from US EPA Region 4 Air Permitting, and I have with me Eva Land and Gloria Diaz.
I'm Barbara Rudnick, the NEPA coordinator for Region 3, and I have Aaron Blair for 404, and I believe Amy Johansson for AIR also.
Morning. Anyone from the National Park Service?
Yes, this is Mary Kruger. I'm Energy Specialist for the Northeast Region of the National Park Service.
Do we have anyone from NASA, Wallops? Okay. Anyone from the Bureau of Safety Environmental Enforcement?
Hey, Casey, Sherry Hunter and Mark Kozak.
And do we have any elected officials, federal elected officials, or their representatives? Okay, thank you. And now we'll go to local state representatives, and starting with North Carolina.
Casey, this is Jennifer Mont, North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality.
Jennifer. Anyone else from North Carolina state agencies? Okay. Go to any North Carolina elected officials or local government. Okay. Virginia, state agency officials.
Deputy Secretary of Commerce.
Okay. I heard you. Angela, I think you came in broken up. That was Angela Navarro, please.
Yes, Deputy Secretary of Trade.
Okay.
Hi, this is Bettina Rayfield with the Department of Environmental Quality.
It's Al Christopher, Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy.
Anyone else in Virginia? Okay. Any other state representatives from Maryland? Okay. With that introduction, thank you all for joining us today. We appreciate your time and interest. I'm going to go briefly over the bullets on the left-hand side of the screen to give you an overview. Everyone should have a copy of the agenda for the day. But the reasoning for the framework of discussion today is centered around the regional activities that are currently occurring off of northern North Carolina and Virginia, and we are going to give you the opportunity to hear from developers and the states with their interests and initiatives and progress that has been made to date. We are available to discuss broader issues at later dates, but we believe it's just important to maintain open communications and make sure, although we may not deal with all of you on a daily basis, that is known that the task force exists outside of this room and is ongoing. And so we're trying to maintain our communication chain and provide you a regularly scheduled update, and that is the focus of the call today. With that, I will turn it over to our program manager, Jim Bennett, for opening remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Casey. Good morning, everyone. And on behalf of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, I want to thank you for joining us today for the Virginia and North Carolina Intergovernmental Renewable Energy Task Force webinar. My name is Jim Bennett. I'm the Program Manager for the Office of Renewable Energy Programs here at BOEM. I want to thank in particular the members of the task force for taking the time to discuss current regional updates regarding offshore wind development, the state agencies, and in particular Jennifer Munt from North Carolina and Angela Navarro from Virginia. The reason we have this intergovernmental state task force is because state and local leadership is essential to making offshore wind a reality in the United States. I'd like to commend our state government counterparts for their continued commitment, vision, and leadership. I'd also like to thank the members of the public who are here today and to our stakeholders representing industry, maritime, and environmental organizations, the fishing community, and other key constituencies. Your knowledge and experience is important and valued as we move through this process. We are facing a situation where demand for offshore wind energy has never been greater. Technological advances, falling costs, increased interest, and tremendous economic potential make offshore wind the most promising avenue for increasing the national energy portfolio under an all-of-the-above energy strategy here. In particular, I'd like to point out that last month, BOEM approved the CVOW Research Activities Plan revision and off the Virginia coast, and groundbreaking occurred just earlier this month, and this represents the Bureau's final approval necessary to begin construction on the project. I want to congratulate Al Christopher and the Virginia Department of Mines and Minerals and Energy on this major accomplishment. Well, we're looking forward to the possibility of the first federal OCS deal in the water with this project. It's a great step forward leading to larger possibilities with the Dominion lease and with Avangrid's Kitty Hawk lease. Any development that we do on the Outer Continental Shelf must consider a number of different factors affecting both users and the marine environment. And that's why engaging stakeholders like yourself, including federal, state, local agencies, elected officials, fishing communities, and the public, in our process is such an essential part of our offshore energy program. It helps us ensure that information needs, stakeholder concerns, and effective solutions are identified and addressed through all of our planning and leasing processes. These meetings are essential to the successful future development of wind development, of offshore wind development in the region. I'd like now to introduce Jennifer Munt, Senior Policy Advisor for the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, for her opening remarks.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Jim, for that introduction, and thank you to Casey and Will and the rest of your colleagues there at BOEM for organizing this task force meeting between North Carolina and our colleagues to the north in Virginia. I would just like to echo much of what Jim just shared regarding North Carolina's future and potential for endeavoring into offshore wind industry and energy generation. We're really excited here from this vantage point to see what's been happening in the Northeast with respect to the development and the investment and the interest that has been expressed by the industry and all of the subsequent supply chain movement that is following that activity. Here in North Carolina, we are ready to jump into being an active player in this industry, as well as working collaboratively with our neighbors here in
our neighbors to the north in Virginia, as well as looking to other regional opportunities within the Southeast region. I'll talk more about that later with some of my updates. And I just want to stress a little bit more what Jim said with respect to stakeholdering. We couldn't do what we do here in North Carolina without the input and feedback and suggestions that we receive from all of our stakeholders across the state, whether they be local governments, folks from communities, folks representing regulated industries, advocates, and all manner of the sectors out. And so it's very important that we maintain these lines of open communication and that we look forward to continuing to do so. So with that, I will pass it back to the moderator.
Okay. This is Will Waskis. Thank you, Jennifer, for those opening remarks. We're now going to move over to the Commonwealth of Virginia, to Angela Navarro, the Deputy Secretary of Commerce. Great.
Thank you, Will. Of course, thank you to Casey and to Jim for organizing the webinar today. We're certainly thrilled to talk about the developments in Virginia. We're very deeply committed to offshore wind, and as Jennifer mentioned, both the resource itself, but then also the supply chain and economic development prospects along the East Coast and within the U.S. market. And the offshore wind resource off the coast of Virginia is certainly in line with our state-level legislative objectives, deeming at least 5,500 megawatts of wind and solar in the public interest. We have some near-term targets of achieving at least 3,000 of those megawatts, either constructed or under development by 2022, and we know that offshore wind will play a role in meeting our longer-term and shorter-term targets. As Jim mentioned, we have our Coastal Virginia Offshore Wind Research and Demonstration Project, and we were just out at Camp Pendleton about 3 weeks ago breaking ground on the onshore transmission infrastructure for that project. So we're really thrilled that that project is moving forward. We've had tremendous stakeholder engagement, worked a lot with BOEM and other federal agencies and state agencies and private stakeholders to move that project along. And we're excited that it's on track for a 2020 completion date. We also have our larger commercial wind energy lease area that can host about 2,000 to 2,400 megawatts of offshore wind, and I'm sure we'll discuss the progress on that commercial wind energy lease area a little bit later today. But we in the governor's office have put out a public goal that we would like to see construction of that project commenced by 2024, and so we're really interested in seeing how we can move that project forward and get as much stakeholder engagement and buy-in as possible. And then I'll just close by saying that I know a number of other states have expressed interest, and certainly Virginia has as well, in further development of offshore wind resources off our coast as BOEM continues to explore additional lease opportunities. So we look forward to continuing to work with our federal and state partners in developing additional long-term offshore wind opportunities off our coast. So thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Angela. That concludes the opening remarks for today. Our next item on the agenda, we're going to be moving back to James Bennett, our program manager, who's going to be providing kind of a Atlantic-wide update of all of our current activities and progress that's been made to date with our program.
Thanks, Will. I have some information to provide on some background and basics of the program and our activities here in the Atlantic. Again, my name is Jim Bennett. I'm with the I'm the program manager for renewables. I know a lot of you are already very, very familiar with the program, and I ask you to bear with us if a lot of this information is you're already familiar with. But for the benefit of those who aren't, it might be very useful to go back over some of the basics and. We can start with who we are on the Outer Continental Shelf. We operate as a federal agency, excuse me, under the OCS Lands Act. The OCS, the Outer Continental Shelf, is considered a vital national resource, and our job is the expeditious and orderly development of the energy resources, the energy and marine mineral resources of the Outer Continental Shelf, subject to appropriate environmental safeguards. In 2005, we were granted authority to issue leases for energy from sources other than oil and gas. We operate in four regional offices, including the Alaska region, which is looking at frontier areas for oil and gas, the Pacific, which has both oil and gas, as well as planning activities for renewable energy, the Gulf of Mexico, which you may be familiar with in terms of supplying over a quarter of the oil and gas resource for domestic energy, and, of course, the Atlantic, which I'm going to focus on a little bit here, which is almost exclusively about renewable energy and wind energy in particular. And the reason for that is because the we have a recipe for success in the East, and that's simply that it's the right combination of the key factors, including the wind resource. We're often referred to as the Saudi Arabia of wind as far as the East Coast Outer Continental Shelf is concerned. But we also have a buildable environment for the resource and the technology that we have currently in place to develop that resource, the shallow sloping shelf that allows us to build the bottom-founded wind turbines. And, of course, the third piece of that recipe is market demand. And as you can see here in a night sky picture, the Northeast is ideal and for the demand that is necessary to support offshore wind. And offshore wind is a location that is simply not available onshore for large-scale wind energy development. However, one thing to keep in mind in all of this is that what's essential to a successful development of these resources offshore is state policies and state activities. And in the past several years, the goals of the various states have blossomed in a way that is making wind energy even more and more attractive. The most recent developments, of course, are the awards that have been given by the state of New York and the declaration of a 9-gigawatt goal for the state of New York. State of Connecticut has recently identified a 2-gigawatt goal for its needs, and there are other states, of course, that are very supportive of developing the offshore resource. In order to develop these leases offshore, it takes a substantial amount of onshore support, and that includes you can see it, port facilities it starts with. Yes, the port facilities that are potential that are developing on the East Coast from New Bedford in Massachusetts. Testing facilities, looks like the format has gotten a little squirrely on that, but keep going. We also have the development of onshore testing facilities and academic institutions up and down the East Coast, which is going to be critical as we shift from a international support for these activities to more of a localized support. So where are we? I'll go on to the next one. One more. Here at the Office of Renewable Energy Programs, we have issued 15 commercial leases. Every state from Massachusetts to North Carolina has at least one federal OCS leased offshore. From Cape Cod to Cape Hatteras, every state is covered. But we're also, and we have more leasing anticipated in the future. You can go ahead and click it. One more time. Okay. We also anticipate more leasing, particularly in the New York Bight, and one of the reasons for this call today is to discuss further what the possibilities are off of Virginia and North Carolina and what the level of interest is. But we're also transitioning in the program from a focus on leasing to a focus on not only leasing, but also the review of plans. We currently are reviewing 4 construction and operations plans, and we anticipate up to 7 more over the course of the next 12 months. So we've got a lot of activities coming forward, and we're looking forward to addressing all of those. In addition, we've got planning activities going on the Pacific Coast. One more click. And we'll talk a little bit about issues and opportunities real quick. First off, job creation is very substantial, and studies indicate a typical commercial scale offshore wind farm will generate 10,000 full-time equivalent jobs, as well as 10 to 15,000 full-time equivalent jobs as the industry develops. And also local content is expected to expand from 40% to 70% as the industry matures. I also want to mention the industry synergies that can exist. In particular, the Block Island Wind Farm and State Waters off of Rhode Island was built upon foundations, literally, that were constructed in the Gulf of Mexico. Excuse me, as a result of the industrial capacity that is already down there for the oil and gas industry. Keep going. We have issues and opportunities that we have to address with regard to transmission, whether the model that we are currently using, giving developers the ability to construct the line for each and every one of their projects, or whether some other backbone or framework architecture would be a better way to go. We have tremendous opportunities in terms of turbine growth that are currently underway. The Block Island turbines are 6 megawatt. We're currently looking at probably 9.5 megawatt machines for the next commercial scale possibility. GE has already announced, I think it's 12 megawatt machines. You can click a couple times here. And they actually have on the drawing boards 50 megawatt possibilities for design, forwarding designs, or developing designs by 2025. It doesn't appear to be a clear restriction on these efforts at this point. And it's very important because this technology enables increased productivity in that doubling of the diameter of the turbines results in a quadrupling of the energy output. So there's great potential and possibilities down the road. We do have issues and opportunities that we have to address regarding other users, including commercial fisheries, including the loss of fishing grounds, the potential for loss of fishing grounds, safety, identifying appropriate fishing practices. There are issues with regard to visual impacts offshore and what effects that might have on tourism and property values, as well as historic landmarks and properties. Navigation and safety is a big factor in identifying the areas that we can move forward with offshore. And finally, environmental concerns, such as the right whale and other considerations have to be factored in to decisions that we make. The reason we're pointing all this out is that because in addition to our own efforts, we lean very heavily on the information the states already have about their environment offshore so that we can make the best possible decisions. And in terms of our own efforts, I just want to note that we've spent tens of millions on environmental information that is applicable directly to the renewable energy program through our environmental studies program, which has been in place for several decades now. Using that program to work with the states and universities has been very effective in collecting the information we need. One example is Rodeo, the real-time opportunity for development of environmental observations. Thank God it's on the slide because you can never remember what the acronym stands for. This is an effort in particular up in Rhode Island to make observations of what's actually happening with those wind farms, with that wind farm up there, as well as activities as they develop elsewhere on the East Coast. I want to talk a little bit about process. This is what some folks believe is a long process, and it is a long process. I want to point out that it takes a couple of years of planning and working with the Intergovernmental Task Force and state agencies to develop the areas that we think we should be moving forward with. And moving from there into a leasing phase, I think we need a couple clicks there. the notices that are necessary for that process can take a year or more. And we conduct an auction at the end of that process and issue leases. That triggers a roughly a five-year period in which developers can develop can conduct site assessment and collect the information needed to put together a construction and operations plan. And that step in the process, after approval of the COP, the construction operations plan, triggers a leasing period of could be 25 to 33 years, and that entire process includes decommissioning at the end of that time period. So what are we looking at over the next decade? Got to go back one. One too many clicks there. Go back one if you can. Now click. Okay. What are we looking at over the next decade? We're looking at, based on the existing leases that we have, potentially a dozen projects up and down the East Coast, including the projects off of Virginia and North Carolina. It's going to be an extremely interesting decade for offshore wind, to say the least. Go ahead, Casey. And I'd just like to leave you with an observation that we have about activities that began 20 years ago or more over in Europe. And in this case, this is a comparison. Go ahead and click. A comparison between the eastern coast of Great Britain and the east coast of the United States, which are comparable in length. They've been at it for 20 years, and they have their first, I believe it's 10 gigawatts in place. And that's what we're looking at least from the projects that we identified in the previous slide. One more. But what is really interesting from this observation, and one more, is that while we're building our first 10 gigawatts, they've already have plans. The industry has developed to the point where they're planning for another 28 gigawatts. It's a very impressive situation over there. If that applies to the East Coast, it's going to be, like I said, a very interesting decade in the 2020s. We are looking for, if you could click one more, I'm sure many of you are already familiar with the, go ahead, you can just click right through. The effort that we undertook to identify the areas with the greatest potential for additional leasing here on the East Coast, we would very much like to get input both from industry and from the states as to what areas offshore they think are the most promising, recognizing the various factors that we just identified as helping us to shape the areas that we would be going forward with. With that, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you. I'd like to turn it back to the moderator to move forward with the rest of our agenda. And again, I want to emphasize that the work that we do with you all through the Intergovernmental State Task Forces is critical to the successful forward motion that we have underway. Thanks.
Okay, we're going to take a few minutes to see if there are any questions for Jim. Carol, that's something that you can help with in terms of.
Thank you. Yes, we'll begin a question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment from the phones, please press star 1. Make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name to introduce your question. And to withdraw that request, you may press star 2. Once again, for questions or comments, press star 1.
And this is Will again, and this is just a reminder for this portion of the task force meeting. This is for task force members only. We'll have a separate QA session later, roughly around noonish for the public. So again, questions that come in should really only be from task force members.
With that pause, as everyone develops their questions, I would like to take the opportunity right now to anyone who is a task force member who missed the roll call earlier to acknowledge their presence today. Your line should be open if you're on mute.
Robert Mathias, City of Virginia Beach and member of Virginia Offshore Wind Development Authority.
Lieutenant Brittany Akers, Sector North Carolina, Coast Guard.
Thank you.
Any questions on the line?
Will, this is John Stanton, Fish and Wildlife. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, Will, I have a question. I appreciate Jim's overview of the leasing process and the offshore wind development process. I recognize the buckets and the arrows from the planning analysis to the leasing phase, the site assessment phase, and then the construction and ops. As a task force member, I've been trying to understand the process. You guys have, you know, reminded us of the process many times, and I very much appreciate that. But I still seem to lose track of where in the process we get to more of the final footprint after the site assessment or during the site assessment, how that progresses into a review or an environmental assessment of the particular site, because the lease area itself is, you know, typically large. They may not be developing the entire project, but where in that process is it, at the site assessment phase or at the prior to the approval of the ops or the COPS plan, that there's environmental review of all the federal trust resources?
This is Jim. We'll talk specifically about the these individual projects in much greater depth in just a minute. In general, the answer to your question is that the site assessment phase, which does have environmental review associated with it, feeds into a construction and operations plan. It is the construction and operations plan that is then submitted by the developer that undergoes very thorough review, including a full-blown environmental impact statement to ensure that we identify all potential impacts and mitigate to the extent possible. So I think the short answer to your question is that it is with the submission of the COP that we have those details. However, we should note that the submission of the COP does not occur in a vacuum. It's something that is developed over at least a couple of years during the site assessment phase in order to ensure that when it is submitted, it represents or addresses what we know will be the issues associated with that particular project. To answer specifically with regard to North Carolina or Virginia, do you want to defer to the presentations or do you want to address that now?
Yeah, I think Jim covered it well. Unless you have any direct questions, John, this slide that I put up kind of just shows a representative example of where the projects we'll be hearing from today are in that process.
Very good. Yeah, that's an excellent explanation. You know, what caught my attention was that, you know, in the next 12 months, you're expecting maybe 7 COPs to start forming up or coming forward. And I know Jim was just trying to hit all the highlights, but that caught my attention. Therefore, my question and that answer satisfied it very much.
Okay. And as we go throughout the day, just so task force members are aware, the intent is to allow padding in the schedule for Q&A and for discussions. We're hoping this is a open communication effort, and we are anticipating more discussions throughout the day. So I think administratively, there isn't going to be the requirement, as was stated by the operator, to chime in, pound one. Lines are available to task force members for the open discussion throughout the morning. The public will have an opportunity to speak directly to the task force in the afternoon.
This is Will. I've also seen a couple of questions come in on the chat box about the presentations. The presentations will all be posted on the BOEM website later today, probably not too long after this concludes. They'll be both on the Virginia State pages as well as the North Carolina State pages. So if we don't have any more questions for Jim, we will move on to our next section of the agenda. And this will be a presentations from both of our states, which are pillars to our task force. First up, we're going to hear from North Carolina to talk about some of their recent state initiatives and updates going on within the state related to offshore wind. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jennifer Mott.
Thank you, Will. And again, thank you to Jim and Casey for bringing us all together here this morning and for giving me the opportunity to provide this update to all of you. Again, my name is Jennifer Munt, and I serve as a senior policy advisor in the Office of the Secretary of the Department of Environmental Quality, and I also serve as Governor Roy Cooper's designee to the North Carolina Renewable Energy Task Force. And so with that, I am just going to jump right in, and next slide, please. So to reorient everybody to a North Carolina-specific space, Jim just provided you with an update about where we are along the Atlantic coast, but I want to point everybody to where we are and illustrate the locations of the wind energy areas that are off our coast here. Each of these areas were identified during a deconflicting surveying and evaluation that BOEM led between 2011 and 2016 with the previous iteration of our North Carolina task force. The Kitty Hawk area, which you'll see to the north, is held under lease by Avangrid. And I trust that we'll hear a lot more about the progress on the leasehold and what opportunities it can support for energy generation later this morning from the project developer or the project development director, Craig Poff. The two wind energy areas that were identified in the southern waters off our state, the Wilmington East and West areas, were identified during that same process back between 2011 and 2016. Progress on leasing those two wind energy areas is presently on hold while we work with BOEM to help evaluate and address local concerns that development and operation of wind near shore will negatively impact tourism. Based on those concerns that we had heard over the past several years, the communities have requested that there be a 27-mile buffer put in place to ensure that those structures were not visible from shore. And based on calculations, a 27-mile buffer would completely eliminate the Wilmington West area from use, would significantly reduce the size of the Wilmington East wind energy area, and due to the locational proximity to South Carolina's coast, would significantly impact the proposed Grand Strand Wind Energy Area to the south. And so these areas represent the areas that have been identified thus far for North Carolina's outer continental shelf. Jim pointed out before that just as he was completing his materials, that BELM had recently put out its request for feedback regarding its path forward for future offshore renewable energy leasing on the OCS, and has proposed to conduct a high-level assessment of all the waters off our coast for potential additional lease locations. Last year in June, North Carolina responded with vehement support for such an assessment. Michael Regan, our agency secretary, submitted a comment in full support of BOEM's proposal to identify additional lease areas off our coast for offshore renewable energy development, provided full consideration of exclusionary and positive factors takes place. Next slide, please. So what I just described on the previous slide are the actions and activities that resulted from the work led by BOEM and, by extension, the work of North Carolina's previous task force. And as we've watched the Northeast growing its offshore wind industry through policy procurement requirements that industry has responded favorably to with interest and with hundreds of millions of dollars in investment, we here in North Carolina are working to position our state to take advantage of the best practices and the lessons learned from our northern neighbors, not only to lure industry investments here to North Carolina, but also to identify opportunities for commercial development in our OCS waters. So much of what we've done here in state thus far has been modeled on the successes that we've witnessed in other states heretofore. For instance, we've convened a small group of state government staff to regularly meet with industry and energy experts to help create a vision for North Carolina's offshore wind strategy. This strategy team continues to provide updates to a group of leaders in our state's administration, and we found that some of our ideas have been in perfect alignment with our governor's vision. In fact, in this year's budget proposal, Governor Cooper included a line item for a ports assessment and transportation infrastructure assessment, as well as a supply chain study for offshore wind. The House version of the budget included a similar provision, which was, however, not included in the Senate's budget when the bill went to conference. Again, building on what others have learned in the Northeast, we've been pursuing opportunities for regional cooperation in the Southeast. We'll hear more from Andy Geisbuehler and the recommendations from BVG Associates for Virginia. And here in North Carolina, we're also responding to the messaging that we're hearing from developers that they want states to work collaboratively in a regional structure to meet the needs of this rapidly growing industry. Another component of the strategy that we're developing involves identifying opportunities and venues for our staff to meet with leaders and movers in the offshore wind supply chain, as well as developers, to learn about the industry's needs and to share North Carolina's assets and strengths with them. And lastly, we're working to integrate offshore wind in the implementation of Governor Cooper's Executive Order 80. Next slide, please. Thank you. So since the last time this task force convened, either individually as for North Carolina or as a joint task force with Virginia, our state administration has affirmed its commitment to address climate change. And recognizing that climate change and its impacts are already being felt across the state, and what our state and the fact that we have a role in combating climate change, Governor Cooper signed on October 29th of last year Executive Order 80, North Carolina's commitment to address climate change and transition us to a clean energy economy. This order underscores our state's support of the Paris Agreement goals and our commitment to the United States Climate Alliance, and pushes North Carolina to reduce statewide greenhouse gas emissions by 40% below 2005 levels by 2025. There are several provisions and requirements that are set out in the executive order to help achieve these greenhouse gas emissions reductions and plan for and mitigate climate change impacts. And I'm going to talk more about those on the next slide as to how they relate to offshore wind. Please, next slide. So two of the sections of EO 80 contemplate offshore wind. The first is the development of a clean energy plan for the state, and the second is the conduct of a clean energy workforce assessment. So under the executive order with respect to the clean energy plan, my agency, the Department of Environmental Quality, is directed to collaborate with stakeholders to increase the utilization of clean energy technologies, energy efficiency measures, and clean transportation solutions. In order to achieve this goal, the Department of Environmental Quality has conducted an open and inclusive stakeholder-driven process similar to the participation that BOEM solicits during the convening of its task forces. My understanding is that a draft of the Clean Energy Plan will go out for public comment early next month, and that the final plan is due per the executive order to the governor by October 1st of this year. Also due to the governor by October 1st is our Department of Commerce's Clean Energy and Clean Transportation Workforce Assessments. According to the Department of Commerce and their webpage dedicated to this process, the department is working to identify the state's existing talent pool and future workforce demand, assess employers' current and future workforce skills and training needs, compiling educational program offerings, enrollment trends, and work-based learning opportunities, and recommended actions to help North Carolinians develop the required skills and education to pursue gainful employment in the clean energy and clean transportation industries. So similar to the processes undertaken by DEQ, the Department of Commerce has engaged in an open process throughout its assessment through consultation with organizations in energy and transportation sectors to identify specific industries and employers regarding current and future skill needs as well as challenges, meeting with public and private education institutions regarding their offerings for programs and course assessments, enrollment trends, and work-based learning opportunities. The Department of Commerce will also put out its draft assessments for public comment before they're finalized and submitted to the governor. Of course, you can see that between the Clean Energy Plan and a Clean Energy Workforce Assessment, there is room for both offshore wind, for both energy development and for supply chain and supporting that supply chain with the workforce. Next slide, please. So that really concludes my overview and remarks, trying to keep these brief and in alignment with what we had promised each other as fellow presenters in our time that we've been allotted. But I just want to take this last opportunity to once again thank BOEM and the industry-led actions by Avangrid here in North Carolina in the offshore wind space. We recognize that there's so much more that a state can do, and we are endeavoring to accomplish that in an order so that we can position ourselves to best participate in this rapidly developing industry, as well as hopefully generate gigawatts worth of energy off our coast. Thanks again to Casey and Will and the folks at BOEM for the opportunity to share our updates with y'all today and for their support in the work that we know is yet to come. And with that, I'll turn it back to the moderator. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. I'll take this moment to see if there are any task force member questions for Jennifer at this time. You can either note them on the phone or use the chat box, either will work. Okay, I do not see anything. So with that, next up will be kind of the second pillar of this joint task force, which would be the Commonwealth of Virginia. Speaking on behalf of the Commonwealth of Virginia, we're going to have two presenters. But up first is Joan Bondaretz. She is chair of Virginia's Offshore Wind Development Authority. And with that, I will turn it over to you, Joan.
Thank you very much. I hope everybody can hear me. I am Joan Bondaretz, and I'm a maritime lawyer in Washington, D.C., but a resident of Virginia. And I've been watching Virginia's progress towards offshore wind for the past 13 years now. First slide, please. Next slide. I'm mainly going to talk about the path forward and what I've seen by way of progress in Virginia over the last 13 years so you know how far we've come. The Virginia Offshore Wind Development Authority, which I chair and for which I'm grateful to have many excellent members, some on the phone with us today, was created by state law in 2010 to promote offshore wind in Virginia and authorizes us to enter into public-private partnerships for the purpose of promoting offshore wind research and giving financial assistance to developers. And I have seen over the years that Virginia has, this whole concept of offshore wind in Virginia has grown from being a seed idea that the legislature had to now where we see the first commercial offshore wind farm on the Outer Continental Shelf actually coming to fruition. The CVOW project, the Coastal Virginia Offshore Wind Project, that's operated, owned and operated by Dominion Energy in cooperation with their manager, Ørsted, has broken ground on the project, as has been said, and echoing those who went on Apollo 11, since we're talking about that, this the anniversary this week, it's one small step for offshore wind in the world of offshore wind, but it's a giant step for offshore wind in Virginia. And we in VOWDA look forward very much to working with BOEM on more wind energy areas, and I'll come back to that in a moment. So what's really made a difference in Virginia in promoting offshore wind and allowing it to go forward is the work of the legislature, not just creating VOWDA, but also enacting last year the Grid Transformation and Security Act. Because in that act, the legislature declared that 2,000 megawatts of offshore wind or this two-turbine, 16-megawatt project called CVOW is in the public interest. And this state law allowed, some could even say require, the State Corporation Commission to approve the CVOW project. The owner of the lease, Dominion, is a regulated utility in the Commonwealth, and therefore most of its work is subject to State Corporation Commission, SCC, approval. Thanks to the foresight of the legislature declaring that CVOW is in the public interest, the SCC was allowed, you could even say required, to approve the CVOW project and allowed it to go forward. This was done in a decision on November 2nd, 2018. And partly they granted approval not because of the legislature alone, but also because they found there'd be no negative impact on ratepayers, the consumers in Virginia for which to which the SEC is accountable. In fact, the $300 million cost of the CVOW project has been built into the existing rate base by Dominion, and the Dominion rep will describe that project in greater detail. Also, compatible with the state legislation, the Grid Transformation and Security Act, Governor Northam, our governor, declared in the 2018 Energy Plan for Virginia that offshore wind in this amount at least would be in the public interest and as part of our goals for renewable energy in the state of Virginia as well as solar development. Finally, a path forward with BOEM. Last April, we sent a letter to BOEM requesting that Virginia be considered for additional wind energy areas. And as part of the stakeholder process, we're very interested in working with BOEM on that. And at the bottom of this slide, you'll see a picture of what one of our ports in Virginia. I think Virginia is fairly well known for its port infrastructure. And we certainly hope that the developers and adjacent states will think of the ports in Virginia as a good opportunity for both turbine assembly and staging of offshore wind projects off our coast. And we look forward to collaborating with other states as the CVOW project moves forward, as well as the commercial wind energy area, whose lease is also owned by Dominion Virginia Energy. Next slide. This is an interesting chart, which I think I just saw the other day for the first time. This is the Department of Defense's perspective on what areas can be and cannot be leased off the coast of Virginia. It looks as if a large area is blocked off, but I've been advised by our state partner, DMME, that while there are conflicts on the Outer Continental Shelf that DOD Defense has identified, there's still many unconflicted areas in shallow waters close by that would be available for lease. And these are some of the areas we will be working with BOEM as we go forward on their next path for identifying future wind energy areas, hopefully some off Virginia. Next slide. We also work closely with MARCO and the State Department of Environmental Quality. Laura McKay from DEQ is on VOWDA and has been working closely with the MARCO folks to develop a marine spatial plan for offshore Virginia, and I certainly, and we have been very supportive of that process. I think marine spatial planning has proven in other areas to be an excellent tool to resolve youth conflicts on the outer continental shelf or even in state waters, as the wind project off Block Island proved, because it was able to be sited based on the Rhode Island marine spatial plan. So we certainly endorse this as an excellent tool to resolve youth conflicts. And I just wanted to say in a few remarks in conclusion on behalf of VOWDA and myself, and before I turn it over to Andy Geisfeller, who's done a lot of work on the supply chain in Virginia, that certainly Virginia, both the legislature as well as the governor, has been very supportive of offshore wind over the years. We've taken some modest steps in that area, but there are no really impediments to going forward, both with CVOW, of course, as well as the commercial wind energy area. Virginia, as people know, has a very great business-friendly environment, and both the legislature and governor are very supportive of this form of renewable energy. We certainly look forward to continuing to work with the stakeholders, BOEM, and industry on a path forward for identifying future sites for more offshore wind off the coast of Virginia. As well as we welcome, I'm not sure there are any on this phone call today, but we welcome private off-takers as well to participate in the commercial lease. It's going to be necessary to try to offset some of the costs of the larger projects. As you all know, Amazon 2 has situated its East Coast headquarters in Northern Virginia, and we think they'd be a perfect partner for future offshore wind energy. With that, I'll be glad to answer any questions people have about VOWDA or what's happening in Virginia. And I also wanted to mention that the next VOWDA meeting is on September 12th. We meet in the Richmond area, and all our meetings are open to the public, and we certainly welcome the public's participation. Thank you. And with that, I can turn it over to Andy.
Okay, Andy, do we have you on the call?
And if he's online and sitting with someone, he can press star 0 and I can get his line open.
Okay, while Andy does that, just a short introduction. Andy is the advisory director for BVG Associates, who, as Joan noted, is working with the state and is representing the Commonwealth. Andy, did you make it over?
Again, if Andy is on the call, star 0, and we will get your line open.
Okay, Andy, I see you've just got into the room. We're trying to get you now on audio, so if you could call in to the meeting, I think we'll have you both where you can see, and then you can hear as well.
You want to take questions?
Okay. So, Andy, if you can hear us, the number is in the chat. You need to call in. I guess while we wait for Andy to get over, do we have any questions from the task force members for Joan? We just heard from Andy, and he's calling to the meeting now. So if everyone could just hold tight for 1 minute or two.
Andy has joined at this time.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Andy.
Very nice. Really apologize to keep everyone waiting. I was connected online. I thought that I would work. So I'm on the phone now. Thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts. Actually, in my role as advisory director with BVG Associates, I've been supporting Virginia DMME to develop the roadmap for offshore wind supply chain, and that report has been made public in December 2018. In the few slides to come, and please move forward to the next slide, I will share first some general market information with a thought exactly as Jennifer already expressed that, we're looking to the north. That's where the industry really has taken off first, and there's a lot of learning potential. You know, like we apply the European learning curve, we now also have access to the northeastern learning curve, which is very valuable. And then in the second part, I will share the recommendations for the Virginia roadmap. So on this slide, I think there's nothing you have not seen, what I reflect here on that slide, but it represents a significant change from the time when we had our last Bond Task Force meeting in December 2017. First of all, the offtake agreements, or mostly PPA awards, actually have far exceeded 4 gigawatts already, so we're already now nearly at 5, with more to come this year. And then, of course, a lot of that has been driven by the state policies, with New York in the lead, but others also having increased their targets, and that's really a driver for the industry. Now, the lease area, the auction results, I think, first in New York and then in Massachusetts, definitely demonstrated that there's commitment with the stakeholders, there's commitment with developers to make significant investments, and that's only done based on a solid assessment that this market is real. So I think that's very, very helpful to see develop, and I think the Mid-Atlantic and South Atlantic areas will benefit a lot from that initial push in the north. On the next slide, please. This is just a visualization of what's happening right now. So you see, first of all, an assumption of how the market will develop, solely driven by state policy. And I would say in the early years, that's pretty much representing known projects, and in the later years, that is more, one scenario how it could evolve, and this is likely to increase further. But as already mentioned by Jim Bennett, we're talking the state-driven commitments exceed 20 gigawatts, and we have an additional commitment anticipated. This slide is a very nice reflection of the opportunity we see being a second mover, in Virginia and North Carolina, meaning by the time we implement our wind farms here, we already will have gone through the first learning curve example experience, and will deal with a much more localized and a much more mature industry to ultimately support, of course, industrial effectiveness, but also predictability in execution, which, as you can imagine, for that size project is absolutely critical. The next page, I would say, is just a backup for you all to study. Could you switch to the next slide, please? I will not go through the details. It's more a helpful listing to illustrate how the numbers are derived and what the assumptions were to come up with these fairly impressive numbers as we really see now trending the industry towards 28 or even more gigawatts by 2035. I'd like to move to the next one, please. That is actually the same chart we have seen before, but it now specifically outlines the currently known offtake agreements of the, and that really applies to the industrial commercial scale projects, front-end loaded in the Northeast with, as I mentioned before, 5 gigawatts of offtake agreements. I think this is extremely relevant as that probably exceeds any expectations we had before. And I think that also would allow everyone from a supply chain infrastructure investment point of view, it gives the necessary credibility that this market is happening because the states are absolutely serious about the energy policy, and we see the developers who are all very experienced, proven large players making massive investments and taking significant risk. And I think this demonstrates that all the stakeholders are really ready to pull through and make this all happen. On the next slide, we'll see what that means now for Virginia, and I think probably very similarly also applies to North Carolina, that first of all, you know, what you see on that slide are the 5 key recommendations of this roadmap for the Virginia supply chain. And the first key recommendation is what we say, the Virginia Office for Offshore Wind, which provides a kind of a one-point interface with the main objective to facilitate and coordinate the stakeholders, but also to leverage resources to ensure that the dialogue is facilitated, and especially also that the existing capabilities in Virginia and, you know, neighboring states, as well as the U.S. offshore capabilities in the Gulf and potential partners overseas, that all these stakeholders are actually communicating and sharing information. The second main recommendation, and I think this is very unique, which has not happened elsewhere on the East Coast, is this multi-state regional supply chain cluster approach. I think it's very impressive how North Carolina and Virginia are communicating on that topic. Also the fact that this bond task force meeting is addressing both states, I think, is another demonstration that this is the right approach. It makes sense as the industry is reaching scale that we more and more optimize to find the industrially and logistically best and most competitive solution in order to make this industry even more competitive. And as we now see more and more very high volumes, I think that also eases the challenge that, of course, every state likes to secure volume and job creation and involvement. And with the industry growing so rapidly, I think that allows now both that each state plays a key role, but at the same time that we optimize it in a way that we pursue the industrially most opportune and most effective structure. And actually, the photo on the left explains that too. It doesn't actually require a lot of explanation because it's very visible that there's tremendous potential. There's the Virginia port infrastructure is recognized as very significant and very impressive, and that definitely is exactly what the offshore wind industry is looking for to reach full scale. The third recommendation is, of course, to jumpstart the supply chain, and that's usually the most effective way is to attract some larger players, so ideally some tier one suppliers to the region. And with the region, I mean, you know, North Carolina, Virginia, possibly Maryland, basically this whole area. And that will then jumpstart the industry and also attract additional industry, and most importantly, connect with the existing very far developed capabilities, especially in shipbuilding and offshore activities and in general industrial activities. The recommendation number four goes in the same direction to acknowledge that, I mean, the infrastructure challenge and investment is significant, meaning it will take partnerships to bear the business risk, to come up with the liquidity, to make the investments, but also to form groups which together have the capability to pull through and actually materialize the large-scale nature of the business we need. So I think most important probably is to address the infrastructure readiness, and that's what this point four is focused on. And then point five, very, very important, is to grow the opportunities through workforce development. And I think the key there is, on one hand, to attract the industry which is very much aligned with existing activities, so that the current capabilities are applied. Of course, there's an interest to add new types of industry and new capabilities required. And very important is also to time this activity. It should not be too late, so that the local workforce is ready for the business, but it also should not be too early, because those people going through those programs expect jobs immediately after completing those programs. So that is, again, as you can imagine, requires a lot of collaboration with the various stakeholders, and also, again, to draw the learning curve from Europe and the Northeast to make sure that those programs are very focused on the needs of offshore wind. And on my last slide, I would like to kind of re-emphasize the importance of working in integrated teams. On this slide, you basically see the Virginia team under the leadership of the governor's office, and of course facilitated by DMME. And then you see the other key players like VDP, the Virginia Economic Development Partnership, the TCE, the Career Engineer or Advanced Technology Center, and other centers with focus on education and, of course, on growing the workforce in the right strategy and in the right timing. ODU University, I probably would like to link that also to the Virginia XCOM, which is also under the leadership of ODU. That is a group which assembled the senior stakeholders in Virginia to support the activity. I probably should have started with VAUDA, because VAUDA has been the vehicle to drive that whole initiative forward from the beginning. And then key stakeholders is the Port of Virginia and the Virginia Maritime Association and the Virginia Ship Repair Association. And so I think this illustrates the benefit and effectiveness of a collaborative approach And the key would be that, of course, now we would add teams from North Carolina and other stakeholders and possibly other states to advance the industry together. These were my slides. I'm happy to address questions and hand back to the moderator. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andy. We'll take a few minutes to see if any task force members have questions for Andy. If so, just chime in now, or if you prefer, use the chat box. Okay, I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much, Joan and Andy. It looks like we're a little bit ahead of schedule, not too much on our agenda. So I think for two items, one, I just want to make a small announcement just to note we may have a small IT issue that comes up around the top of the hour where there's the potential, I'm not saying this will happen, that the webinar disconnects. If it does disconnect, we will just log back in, and if everyone else could just log back in, it'll be the same email address, the same call-in number. But just in the event that happens, I don't want anyone to think that we just things ended. So that would be the path forward. If everything just kind of the room says it's exited and ended, just basically go back to the same link that's in the invite and use the same call-in number.
And we apologize for any inconvenience if it does happen.
Correct. So with that, I think we'll just, for agenda timing, we were to take a break at 10:45. It's now 10:35. So I think we'll take that break now, and we will reconvene. I have 10:36, so we will reconvene at 10:41. had a request for an additional 5 minutes to take the full 10-minute break, which is a little bit of an error on my part. I thought the agenda had a 5-minute break and not a 10-minute break. So we will reconvene at just after 45.
everyone for joining us today. This is Casey Reeves from BOEM. As we move into the second part of the day, we think it's relevant to give you a kind of a quick overview of Will and myself. As we announced ourselves earlier, we'll be having developers on the line here shortly to discuss the status of the current status of the projects in the region. It's important to note that although the Intergovernmental Task Force is federal state agencies and act under a FACA exemption, but we are able to provide to the task force members updates directly from the developers on invitation. And so that is why the developers will be able to provide directly information and status updates on their project. As we discussed earlier this morning, I myself am the state coordinator for BOEM in Virginia, working on the commercial lease and the research lease for CBOW has been discussed throughout the day. And that is just meant to give you a point of contact. My contact information is at the break slides and will be at the end. But for those who are not familiar with the process, we operate as state leads in the project coordination branch, and my counterpart, Will Vasquez, is the North Carolina lead.
I guess just to give you context for our next session will be developer updates on where they are with their projects. And up first is Craig Paul, who is with Avangrid. So just to kind of prime him up and set him up for, as Casey noted, any new task force meetings. North Carolina worked on that lease area for the North Carolina task force worked on that. We started working with the North Carolina Task Force essentially all the way back in as early as 2010, but really getting a lot of engagement in 2012 to kind of do this, what you see on your left side, the kind of call process and area identification. And their area was a pretty complicated area in terms for us trying to delineate it down to an area that would be suitable, we thought, for leasing. So it did take quite a long time. That process pretty much started with our first Federal Register notices. In 2012, and ultimately taking the interest we got back from industry, we received five companies and a whole list of multiple use concerns that we had to navigate through. So it took a long while to kind of navigate through those, and we ultimately, even though that call went out in 2012, we weren't able to do that basically until about 2014, the end of 2014, for which we then came up with the area that you see now as the Kitty Hawk lease area. So the auction for that lease was held at the end of 2016, and as you can tell, Avangrid Renewables LLC was the winner of that lease area. And they're ultimately moving forward now into this kind of post-leasing process stage into the site assessment and survey stage. And that kind of tees it up and sets it, I think, up nicely for Craig Poff again, who heads up the coordination for Avangrid on lease 0508, also referred as the Kitty Hawk lease. And with that, I will turn it over to Craig. Craig, are you online and available?
I certainly am. Thank you, Will. And I see the first slide up there. So just a refresher, Avangrid Renewables signed the lease in November of 2017. In 2018, we were requested and granted an extension to submit the SAP. So we are due to submit that prior to November 1st of 2019. The slide that's up there right now refers to what we've been doing and where we're headed. Last year was simply planning and outreach. Here in 2019, we're continuing those efforts in planning, assessment, stakeholder outreach. We are also conducting monthly aerial surveys of the wind energy area, enumerating the avian, marine mammals, sea turtles, fish, et cetera, very much consistent with the means and methods that BOEM has already employed using a company called APEM Limited, doing quarterly flights throughout the Southeast. I'm going to provide a little more information on that later in this slide deck. We are also conducting the marine geophysical and benthic surveys in support of the SAP preparation, as well as reconnaissance surveys of the entire wind energy area and cable route. I'll be talking more about that shortly. Those who have been following the PJM interconnect process know that we have been in the queue with 3 800-megawatt applications. Those have recently cleared the feasibility study phase and are moving on towards system impact study next month. And in September is our target to submit the SAP this year. In 2020, continuing that assessment and outreach, we will be deploying, presuming our SAP is approved, deploying FlyDAR and MetOcean equipment in the wind energy area. We'll be wrapping up the aerial surveys of the wind energy area and then continuing to refine the marine geophysical, geotechnical, and benthic survey work along the cable routes and really start to define a project. The wind energy area, just for refresher, is approximately 200 square miles. It's not planned to develop that all in one fell swoop. So there will be a number of projects or phases, whatever you like, of build-out of that project area. So as we conduct these surveys and characterize the site, that really gives us a view on how to approach that in terms of technical challenge, economics, et cetera. Next slide, please. What we're looking at here is a map overlaid onto the nautical chart of the wind energy area that's in the red cross-hatching. And you'll see adjacent to the north and west side of the wind energy area, a gray area. In our geophysical and benthic surveys, we're surveying just beyond the wind energy area on that left side, if you will, really to make sure that we understand the area that might be utilized for cable routes or other potential activities that lead to shore. The green hatched area represents a cable route that we're looking at specifically in our survey program for this year, leading up towards Sandbridge, Virginia. And one of the key components of our planning for this work was coordination with many of you on the line today, including DOD and Navy, NASA, NOAA, NIMS, Army Corps, Fish and Wildlife Service, et cetera, and fisheries interest. Next slide, please. And specifically on those efforts, we've really tried to take lessons learned from those that have gone before us and know that fisheries interests, along with federal stakeholders in the offshore environment, are one we really need to be out ahead with. And so we were, I think, very proactive in reaching out to fisheries folks through the Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council, the South Atlantic Fisheries Management Council, and we've engaged Fathom Edge Limited to act as our liaison. Fathom Edge Principal Rick Robbins is former chair of the Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council and has been walking the docks and reaching out to commercial, recreational, commercial for hire, really making sure that we are communicating effectively and what our activities are, where they're occurring, when they're occurring, And so far, we've been incredibly pleased with the outcome of those efforts. And this time of the year in particular, when we're conducting offshore surveys, there's a considerable amount of weekend tournaments, sport fishing tournaments that transit through the area. And we've been, Rick has been meeting with tournament directors and captains meetings and providing information of how to avoid conflicts and make sure we don't bump into any other uses out there while we're conducting our surveys. Next slide, please. Just a couple photos of what we've got going on out there. The 170-foot Jerry Bordelon is doing the offshore marine geophysical work. There's about 30 people on the boat, including PSOs, effectively mowing the lawn back and forth in that wind energy area. Near shore is the 37-foot Theory survey vessel. It has about 7 crew, including PSOs, and they're from working in the surf zone out to about 8 to 9 meters of sea depth. And that work has been very closely coordinated with the folks at DOD, Vacapes, Jim Casey's group, and making sure that we avoid any conflicts with military uses there around Dam Neck, Oceana, and the mouth of the Chesapeake. And we really appreciate the communications that we've been able to establish and continue to coordinate with those activities. And in fact, this morning we're working through Greg Thomas's group to avoid some operations that are going to be conducted this weekend in the near shore area. So early and often the communication with DOD has been taking place to coordinate those survey efforts. Next slide, please. Thought I'd throw in some pretty pictures from the survey effort. We've been really overrun by marine mammals. They seem to really enjoy surfing in the bow wake of the survey vessel and very curious about the towed instrumentation behind the vessel. I should note that I mentioned the protected species observers that are on the ship. I know many of BOEM are quite familiar with what it takes to coordinate these sorts of activities within the ocean environment to avoid protected species, but some of you may not quite be as aware, certainly I wasn't, of the level of effort it takes to coordinate this sort of work and avoid impacts to protected species. So, for instance, the photograph you see there on the bottom left is a protected species observer in night vision gear who is scanning. There would be 2 people on board during nighttime activities, scanning with night vision gear for marine mammals and other protected species, as well as a passive acoustic monitor who's listening for vocalizations of marine mammals and pinnipeds, et cetera, during nighttime activities. So a lot of interesting work going on there with a very dedicated crew from TerraSond and RPS in coordinating those survey activities. And I should mention Search, our marine archaeologist, who's very involved in the clearance of the buoy deployment areas and weighing in on any other identified cultural or historic resources that will turn up in the surveys. Next slide, please. We are also, as I mentioned earlier, conducting monthly aerial surveys with APIM Limited, covering not only the wind energy area, but a buffer around the wind energy area to make sure we properly characterize the site. Again, coordination with several federal agencies that are and as well as the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission in designing and implementing our survey efforts. What you see that looks like kind of a hatching across this site is, if you were to zoom up on that, you would see thousands of little dots, those records represent the individual locations of each photograph that's taken during each flight. I think it's in the neighborhood of roughly 10,000 photographs per flight. Those are processed using essentially artificial intelligence efforts to kick out potential targets to biologists who then look at the species, identify what they're looking at. If it's an avian, perhaps if the bird is in flight, they can identify the species, and then knowing the species of the bird, know what the wingspan might be and the elevation of the camera system that took the photo, they can determine flight height within a reasonable range. All of this is following Boeing's path and the way that they've done the South Atlantic surveys, and we hope that our data will integrate very nicely into that work that's already been done and further the knowledge of the region and the site. On the next slide, please, I show a few interesting images. Starting at the top right, you'll see a swarm of approximately 23 sharks taken in February. These aren't particularly large sharks. They're only, I think, about 60 centimeters in length. You'll see a dolphin in the bottom right, a northern gannet in the center. And then this larger image on the left, you know, if y'all can are interested, you can zoom in on that. And what you see extending, what you will see when you zoom in from the upper right to the bottom left, is a line of small tunas that appear to be kind of in a hunting formation. Really interesting to see kind of the way these species are using the wind energy area. So a lot more to come in on that as the reporting and data is collected. That's all I have for the slides. Will, you had asked that we kind of note a few of the big challenges and such that we've faced along the way. Certainly, the government shutdown didn't help us along the way as we were trying to process our survey planning back in January. It certainly wasn't a one-for-one delay for us. It was probably a 2-to-4-to-1 delay in terms of being able to eventually get our work approved through BOEM and NOAA NIMS. And then fit it into the resource-constrained survey industry and get that done. We had initially planned to start in early mid-April, and that work was commenced in the 1st of July, essentially. So that's been our biggest challenge, and it sounds like with 4 COPs in the queue and 7 more expected in the near term, resources at the federal regulatory agencies are going to be very stressed and will remain a challenge going forward. So with that, I'll kick it back to you, Will, and any questions that may arise.
Thank you, Craig, very much. Again, we'll stop here and take a few questions for Craig, if there are any, from the task force members. So again, we can take those over the phone or in the chat box.
Hey, Will, this is John Stanton, Fish and Wildlife Service. Thank you, Craig, for that overview. Really appreciated it. Just one question about the coordination for your aerial survey work. You mentioned you communicated with the North Carolina Wildlife Commission and the Fish and Wildlife Service. Do you know specifically who you ended up coordinating with the Fish and Wildlife Service, what office or what branch?
I believe you were on that call back in December, but I'll check my notes. I may be mistaken, John.
Okay, so you hosted a call in December.
Yeah, I believe it was December. It's been quite some time. Maybe it was November, December time frame. I'm glad to check my notes and get back to you.
No problem. I really enjoyed the pictures and that lineup of tuna caught my eye, too, because it appears that there may be a line of gannets above the tuna trying to catch some of the forage fish that maybe tuna are chasing.
Yeah, those were actually just white caps, waves. There aren't any actual avian in that particular image, but it is a very interesting image. Those appear to be... I'm no biologist, but I fish a lot in that area. They're probably false albacore. They're down in about a 60-centimeter body length. But a really interesting image nonetheless.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Any other questions for Craig? Okay, we do see a question in the comment box from Joan. I think that's a little bit more broad than just the Avangrid, so I think we'll tackle those questions after this session's over. So if there's no more questions, okay, if there's no more questions for Craig, we will move on to our next project, our lease that's currently offshore. This one's going to kind of be done, I think, really in tandem together. We have two leases offshore Virginia that are going to be covered. One is the commercial lease, which is held by Virginia Electric and Power. Referred to as OCS-80483. In addition to the CVAL project, or lease 0497, which is held by Virginia's Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy.
Yeah, and just to give you a kind of a lead-in from the project coordinator standpoint, this is Casey again. Both these projects I've been the project coordinator on since really their inception of the commercial lease, going back to around the initial development in 2011 and then the lease sale in 2013. I will not go into details that will be redundant with the presenters' materials, but we're kind of going through the projects in a chronological order as well. So the commercial lease was the second lease that BOEM has issued for renewable energy offshore wind on the OCS, second just to Rhode Island. So Virginia has been long reviewed by BOEM. Following the commercial lease issuance, site assessment plan was submitted and approved, and that's where we're at with that right now. The second lease that will be discussed and the concepts within it are unique, I think, in BOEM's portfolio, in that this was the first research lease issued to a state or federal agency in our program. It followed through with the first project easement that was issued, and the coordination that we've done on this project with multiple agencies since the inception has provided a good vehicle for administrative process to developers and industry. As it was a research lease, all of the information and data that was collected on it, as well as all of the administrative methodologies and functions of the lease, as to the greatest extent possible, have been made publicly available. So it is not a unknown item what a research activities plan synonymous with a COP has been made publicly available, as well as the project easement and the conditions of the approved plan. And in my role as the project coordinator, there was, I think, exhaustive coordination between Department of the Navy, DOD, Coast Guard, Corps of Engineers to make sure we had responsible conditions that were not redundant or conflicting. The Commonwealth of Virginia should take credit in going forward with seeking and securing and moving forward research activities and this lease. So with that, I will turn it over to David Leap, who is the project manager at Dominion, to give an overview, and then George Hagerman with Old Dominion University. So, David, are you on?
I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, let me get your presentation up here.
Okay. Well, thank you, Casey. We appreciate the opportunity to share with you something that is exciting to me. It's the CVAL project. As you can see on the first slide there, that's a typical picture of a typical vessel. I think this one happens to be the CJAX Cilia vessel. It's not the one that we will be using on this project, but it gives you a typical size of a vessel required for the equipment that we're planning to install for the CVAL project. It's about a 1,500-ton crane associated with that vessel, and it gives you a good sense of the size and magnitude of these installations. Next slide. The CVAL project is Coastal Virginia Offshore Wind Project. As Casey mentioned, it's been in the works for quite a number of years, and we are now at the beginning of construction. It will be the first turbines that will be installed in federal waters off the coast of Virginia, directly east of Virginia Beach. There will be 2 6-megawatt Siemens turbines that will be located 27 miles off of the beach. Estimated cost is $300 million, which was approved by our State Corporation Commission last November. The project consists of the 2 turbines, as well as the array cable and then the export cable. There's a 34.5 kV line that extends from the turbines to onshore at Camp Pendleton, and we have started construction of that onshore portion of the interconnect. The onshore consists of 5 segments of the HDD, horizontally directionally drilled conduits, as well as a single offshore HDD segment as well. We see that the process of going with the 2 turbines first is being very beneficial from determining what kind of permitting, to the extent and given us experience with permitting, the design, the installation challenges, as well as learning how to operate these turbines in a more manageable size. We also have learned a great deal through the BOEM approval process with the certified verification advisors and submittal of the RAP and FDR, FIR. So I think it's been a great help to us to understand that process and be able to have that experience going forward for the commercial project. We have an EPC arrangement with Ørsted to build the turbines for us, the offshore portion, and their scope is from a beach interconnect cabinet out to the turbines, including the turbines. We have hired L.E. Myers of the onshore EPC to install the onshore cables through Camp Pendleton, as well as the interconnect substation. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned earlier, we have submitted our approval for our permit, our application to the State Corporation Commission in August and had it approved by them in November 2nd of last year. And we have recently received approval from BOEM for the research activities plan that was amended due to some changes in including the foundation type and turbine vendor. And that was recently approved in June of 21st of this year. We've completed all of our UXO ordnance surveys and thankfully have found none in the path of the turbines or the cables. That effort consisted of really 2 surveys. The first one where we identified magnetic signatures that could have been as a 500-pound bomb or ordnance. We found over 200 of those potentials. And through a detailed process of siting, we avoided all but 10 of those through an established exclusion zone. And so in our second survey, which was completed also in June, in fact, June 20th of this year, we had identified or studied in detail those 10 targets and again found those to be not ordnance, which was a very good thing for the project. We started onshore construction this year in June. We've completed three of the five onshore HDD segments, just the conduit installations. We still have yet to install the cabling, but that's proceeding very well. And we've started the offshore pilot hole drilling, and I think we're at about 1,000 feet into that drill. So we are proceeding well with that as well, and we anticipate pulling the cable in during the month of August. Pulling the conduit in during the month of August. We will plan to install the actual cable next May of 2020. We have completed nearly all the permitting required for that effort. We still have the offshore OCS air permit that has been submitted to the DEQ, and it's currently out for public comment. We are still working on the IHA, the Incidental Harassment Authorization application for the construction activities. We expect to get that in for review very shortly. We are working with the Corps for the individual permit modification to cover the cable protection, the scour protection, and are waiting for issuance of issuance of that approval shortly. The private aid to navigation, working with the Coast Guard, we have, I think, general approval of what we plan to do, but we're waiting for the formal approval on that. And, of course, we have the FDR and the FIR that has been submitted, and we're working closely with BOEM to resolve any questions, comments that they have. And hopefully we'll be getting that in the near term as well. There'll be some remaining activities like working with BOEM on advising of the safety management plan and the oil response plan and those sorts of plans, but those we're working closely with BOEM and various agencies to get those resolved prior to May of next year. Next slide, please. So that's really the summary of the CVAL project, and it's important to understand that the commercial project is obviously separate and immediately adjacent to the east of the research lease that we have. It is 113,000 acre lease area, 27 miles off the coast of Virginia. It's at about a 10 by 15 mile square, rectangle. We believe it would support up to greater than 2,000 megawatts, and we would anticipate developing that in at least three phases. First block could be in service as soon as 2024. And we have received our site assessment plan back in October of 2017, which requires us to submit our COP, or construction operations plan, by April of 2022. We are working on planning this year, and we'll plan to do ocean surveys starting next year for the commercial project. Then the final slide is it's actually a slide from a presentation that we gave on Investor Day, general session presentation back in March of 2019 to investor. Our top executives provided that to Wall Street investors in New York. And it's one of many slides, but I think it's an important slide for offshore wind, and it shows that Dominion plans to spend up to $1.1 billion in the next 4 years on offshore wind. Of course, that includes the $300 million already spent on the CVAL project. But I think it also demonstrates pretty dramatically our commitment to development of offshore wind and our positive opinion of that technology. That's it for me, Casey, unless there's some questions.
All right. Thank you, David. And we'll open up to the task force members. Any questions that you might have on either the research release or the activities
occurring on the commercial lease offshore Virginia.
I think one of the questions is it $200 or $300 million? It's a $300 million project for CVAL project.
Yeah, I think, and it was mentioned in there earlier, and maybe folks aren't aware of, is the process is dynamic as well. Since the initial research activities plan was submitted, just for a point of awareness, many folks may be aware in the permitting agencies, but post-approval of the last plan for the project, two and up to four, I believe, telecommunications lines have left Virginia Beach to all points around the world. Two are completed and installed, and two more are on the horizon with potential for more to come. So it's been a dynamic process to make sure that current activities are considered and BOEM and industry stays aware of those. With that, one more chance for questions to anyone. Okay. We'll move on to the next presentation. Now we'll have George Hagerman from Old Dominion University.
Thank you, Casey. Can you hear me all right? I'm on speakerphone. Am I legible to you all?
I have you loud and clear.
All right, thank you. If I drift away, just remind me to sit closer. All right, so I just want to go over the DMME, of course, holds the research lease. They can only be held by state, federal, or I believe in local government, but only certainly not private. That would be a whole general lease, which is a whole different thing. Anyway, and so what I want to do is just review a quick slide on the status, and then what are we actually doing with the lease to actually add value to the industry by proposing and implementing, if the proposals are successful, projects that will advance the reduce risk and lower cost and sort of accelerate the development of the commercial wind energy market on the East Coast. And so let me just do a quick history slide. Next slide, please. So this is just, this was actually on David's recent presentation. It's a larger view. And so you can see the commercial wind energy area, as David said, each lease block is 3 statute miles by 3 statute miles. So it's a 12 by 15 mile commercial area. And then the colored aliquots, which are just 1/16 of a lease block, so they're 1.2 kilometers on a side. Those are the research lease aliquots. And originally, the whole research lease went in as a single application for all of these, and that was actually in late 2010 and under Governor McDonald's administration. So we've had bipartisan support in Virginia for this research lease activity. It was determined because of having those two that are the research lease one kind of notched into the commercial area, that should go through a different process because of no competitive interest and potential conflict with whoever won the auction. The lease sale had not been held off Virginia at that time. So it was split into two different applications. And then the research lease one aliquots, that was deferred when Dominion and its partners, NREL others, received this award from the Department of Energy for the Virginia Offshore Wind Technology Advancement Project, or VOWTAP. That was the CVOW predecessor project, and so we really needed to accelerate that to meet DOE's timetable for that process. And so Research Lease 2 then was fast-tracked and was executed in March of 2015. And so that's sort of the status. That's where the leases stand on the nautical chart. The orange border, just for those who are maybe new to the task force, this was actually where anything involving site assessment, lease issuance activities, which included the potential for meteorological buoys or even met masts, had a finding of no significant impact in the SMART from the start site lease issuance. So what it says is that these research leases as long as the activities on the research leases conform to Met Tower or Met Buoy, there should be no significant review. But, of course, putting two turbines on indeed triggers the significant review. And so, as David said, and I think also Casey has mentioned, that having these two turbines has really given everyone a first look and a very public look of what the administrative process is to actually do construction and operation. So I think Virginia's done a lot to help inform the entire industry on what construction and operation planning really looks like in terms of best practice. Next slide, please. So now we actually have funding available, and it's a really amazing opportunity that has coincided with the installation of CVOW and moving forward on the research lease in general with other activities like Met Ocean Buoys or Met Towers. And this is the National Offshore Wind Research and Development Consortium. It is a partnership between the Department of Energy and the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, or NYSERDA. They are the administrators of this, and they have a 50% cost share to match DOE's dollar amounts one-to-one. And of that total amount, $32 million will be competitively awarded through open solicitations over the next 4 years. So not just universities or industries based in New York, but the entire country. And I think that's really impressive and a really great opportunity for the entire East Coast. And so what I will focus on is examples of sort of the first two proposals that Old Dominion University is participating in, and to sort of show how these can benefit industry moving forward. So there are three research pillars, and this is really comes out of the National Offshore Wind Strategy that was a joint publication between DOE and BOEM. And pillar one is really the first solicitation that is really focused on looking at offshore wind, not as a collection of individual turbines, but as an actual power plant. So you actually optimize the layout and the control of the turbines as part of a bigger whole rather than just a collection of individual turbines. And array performance and control optimization is where we're focusing a proposal that's being led by NREL, the National Renewable Energy Lab. And then there's the cost-reducing turbine support structures, and that's our second proposal. So I'll go over each of those in the next few slides. Next slide, please. So the array performance and control is really suggested by what we've seen in the strategy. The BOEM and the U.S. Department of Energy assume an installed turbine capacity density of 3 megawatts per square kilometer. And so that yields a southern mid-Atlantic pipeline, which are these areas that are within a day's sail of the entrance to the Chesapeake Bay. If you're traveling at 10 knots or transiting at 10 knots, you would be able to reach the northern end of the New Jersey lease area, or, of course, Kitty Hawk is easily more like a half-day sail or less. And so what we wanted to look at is there a way that the density could be increased on these lease areas and actually end up with a pipeline? You know, Andy's slides had shown something like a 28-gigawatt pipeline. That's for the entire East Coast. But if you were to be able to increase the density without compromising energy production or anything else for that matter, but you certainly would have an opportunity to actually create that kind of pipeline, which would, again, attract major supply chain just to this southern region, the southern Delmarva region with North Carolina and southern New Jersey. That would really be a pipeline that could support all the major Tier 1 components all by itself. So we wanted just to see how could this be done, and it was really NREL that led the charge on this, and that's why they're leading the proposal. But they have numerical studies that show that you could really almost triple the density of turbines that could be on a given lease to almost 9 megawatts per square kilometer. Next slide, please. So this is just an example study. So we've all seen, or many of us who are in this community have seen, the very regular layouts. This one on the left is a European, very similar to the Princess Amalia wind park in the Dutch sector of the North Sea. And NREL showed that by optimizing the position in something that's not at all regular, and of course that has its own implications for the design and engineering, but if this can be practically done without a huge cost burden, you would be able to, in addition to also controlling the wake steering of each individual turbine, you could get up to 70% more energy from a given area, per unit area of seabed that is occupied by the wind project. So this seems like, wow, if we could even realize, 10% of that, I mean, that would be huge. This is an industry that strives for every percentage point it can increase in annual energy production. So the slides will be available and you can study this later, but this is really the nature of what's being looked at. Next slide. So to do that, to physically validate these models, they're all just computational fluid dynamic models. We first need to be able to actually measure the wake and measure the velocity deficit in the wakes and see if they're matching what the models show. And so we're in discussions with Avangrid Renewables, and again, following the theme of collaboration, both North Carolina and Virginia have assets that could really help us, validate these predictions that are strictly numerical models at this point. The Amazon U.S. East project that Avangrid Renewables has just south of Virginia Beach, which was an hour, 90-minute drive, we would be able to actually test various Doppler LIDAR and radar units, and then with suitable permissions and all the required health, safety, and environmental issues that Avangrid Renewables will want to put in place for site access. But we would be able to put sonars directly underneath the wake and then see if we can remotely measure the wake and how far away we can remotely measure the wake. So this is a great test bed, if you will, to the extent that we don't compromise any operational outputs, would be a great test bed for validating the ability to remotely measure wakes and which unit. There are a variety, there are probably a half dozen different units that are on the market now that could do this. So this is something where we've initiated discussions with Craig and his meteorologist and his research director, and we're moving forward on that, and hopefully we'll come to be a way to that we can do this work. Next slide, please.
One second, George. I think we have a global question for folks on the line, and not everyone at once, but can one or two people acknowledge whether or not they have audio on the call right now?
This is Sherry. I do.
Okay.
Same here, Jennifer Mutt in North Carolina.
Okay, thank you, Jennifer. I think that's conclusive enough evidence.
Yeah, it was sounding pretty quiet on my end. I thought, wow, did I hang up on everybody by mistake? I've been talking to thin air, so that's good. Thanks, Casey.
Yeah.
All right, so this is sort of the next step. So once we've identified a top two, maybe one or two units or three maybe, but probably more like one or two, we then have this unique asset at the entrance to the Chesapeake Bay, which is the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel and the artificial island. So we can actually drive to an oceanic environment with all the marine aerosols and all the wave splash and spray, but we can drive to an area that where we can secure equipment behind a fence, where we have lighting and access to service AC power. So we can work out all the kinks before we move something 23 nautical miles offshore. So this is, again, a great part of this National Ocean Test Bed concept. And, again, we hope this is something that through the consortium and DMME's membership in the consortium will be developed over the next 4 years. We early on had met with the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel Commission. We need to almost 10 years ago, so we need to renew that relationship. But we think this is, again, is a promising way to be able to then validate the reach of these remote scanning units, because we have all these coastal meteorological masts that are within the range that we're really trying to calibrate to, which is 10 to 25 nautical kilometers. I'm sorry. So 10 to 25 kilometers, we already have existing net masts with which we can see how well we're doing with these remote instruments. And this then becomes these instruments can then be used to map all of the commercial wind energy areas, which I think is really important because we have a much more variable wind resource offshore than people may believe from looking at the uniform colors on the maps. Next slide, please. So again, this sort of this just shows now we're out into the research lease. You can sort of see this 15-kilometer Doppler scanning range would put us within, if we can reach out that far and demonstrate the equipment will last and is qualified on the third island of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, the next step would be to move that onto a new build platform in the southern Research Lease 1 aliquot, and we would be able to see the anemometry that's on the nacelle of the CVOW turbines if we can, in fact, reach out to 15 kilometers. And as you can see, this is a windrose for our commercial or the research lease area that our winds prevailing from this time of year, they're coming from the south through southwest. And then in the winter, they come over a wider sector, but still largely from the north, from the northeast to the northwest. And so these research lease one aliquots are arranged to have the best Doppler measurement because the winds, the Doppler is how fast the wind is going toward or away from an instrument. So we really want to have good resolution along the line of the prevailing winds. So that sort of really sort of shows why these research leases are configured the way they are. And we just think this is a great opportunity for the country to have a national offshore wind test bed. Next slide, please. So the other research, obviously, if we're going to put LIDAR, they consume a lot of power. They're hard to put on a buoy because you're doing the volume scanning rather than doing a vertical profile, which is what the LIDAR buoys that are out there now are used. And so we need to look at maybe we can use the Carbon Trust in Europe. They put out some innovative foundations, including the twisted jacket that was part of the first VOWTAP concept. You can actually test these innovative foundations by building a MET platform at a lot less cost and risk before you embark a turbine on it. And so we want to look at the suction bucket jacket. We think that that's a very promising foundation. It's already got a high technology readiness level in Europe, pioneered by Ørsted, but also deployed by Vattenfall in off Scotland in the European Offshore Wind Deployment Center. But these require a much they're a very heavy lift because of all the structural steel around the suction cans and the tying in those suction cans to the jacket. So we are working with a Gulf of Mexico platform designer and a Gulf of Mexico platform builder who have an innovative solution to solve this problem of a very heavy lift at a very high hook height because the suction cans also have quite a bit of depth to them. So I can't say any more in this public forum about our proposal, but we believe that we have a way to reduce the cost of suction bucket jackets and really take advantage of their much greater offshore installation season where they could be installed in the winter as well as at night. And then we also want to validate the jacket transparency to the impact of breaking storm waves. That continues to be a concern in our hurricane environment. And last slide. This is, again, you can read through this, but this is a progressive series of proposals that we think will add value to the industry. Separately with a company from Norway, we're looking at, we still think monopiles are going to have a very large role in the East Coast, and we want to start looking at how is fatigue damage accumulating in monopiles as they are hit by waves from hurricanes that may not be anywhere near the coast, but they're sending in these long swell that could create a response and create some accelerated accumulation of fatigue. We'd like to measure that, and so we are in discussions with David and his team about site access terms and conditions, and this is really, like everything else, it's really opened up our eyes as to what's needed in terms of offshore safety training in this country. And I know, Sherry, you're on the line, and I know you'll be talking about this at the jobs workshop in D.C. On Thursday, I think, of this week. And so I think this is something that's really – this is where the research lease will be a good forerunner of how do we actually get people who are not trained turbine technicians but who want to do research or maybe ad hoc workers in the future, which may be needed in commercial projects. If there's an unforeseen incident and you need to get some ad hoc local talent offshore, what kind of training can we get them certified to, and how can – and this is one area where the supply chain needs to be replicated in every state. We actually need safety training capability right where the offshore wind base port is for each of these commercial leases. So here's an area where we don't need to compete. We really should share best practices. And so we're in conversations with Mass Maritime and State University of New York Maritime College, because they're going to be the first ones standing up this offshore wind safety training with all five modules. And that concludes my presentation. You can certainly read through the rest of these, but these hopefully will give you a feel for what we are doing and what we're trying to hope to demonstrate on the CVOW turbines, again, subject to suitable site access terms and conditions and a very solid agreement and among the parties involved, including the turbine manufacturer. That's it for me.
We'll take a minute and see if there are any questions for the group for George or David on the Virginia projects.
I got a question for George. When do you find out about the funding for these projects? Are these all in the hopper right now under consideration?
That's correct. The first one was submitted on the 1st of July, the one that goes directly to the DOE, and we'll learn, we will hear about those in September. So, and then the NYSERDA ones are still under preparation. They're due to be submitted in the next, I would say, in the next 2 weeks. The NYSERDA process is a rolling process, which actually works really well for this kind of evolving program. And so I think every 4 to 6 weeks they will start a new review cycle. I don't know the details of where they are in the first review cycle. I do believe they've already completed one review cycle. So our proposals, the first two that I've just talked about, will be in the second review cycle. I don't know. I'm guesstimating that also probably in the September timeframe would be when we would hear about those two proposals that I just described.
Thank you, George.
At this point in our agenda, we are running quite a bit ahead of schedule. We have 15 minutes with the task force left before we open up for public comments. And we just want to take a moment to go back over the questions of today and make sure that if there's anything that has been put in the chat box that has not been addressed, or that discussion on any of the topics that have been had before we open it up to the public input opportunity, that we catch up with all those loose ends. So bear with me as I screen through to make sure we recognize any comments that were in the chat box. I think it was already covered. All of the presentations will be posted to the both Virginia and North Carolina Task Force pages after the meeting concludes, as well as a recording of the meeting today. A recording may be a few days later for those who may have missed a few minutes of George's presentation. We apologize for the technical difficulties. Do we want to discuss this or table this for the end of the day?
We can take care of
it. Joan, are you still on the line?
Well, okay. We should address it anyways. But, Algene, can you just read that aloud? Because I'm sorry, my eyesight is not what it used to be.
This is Algene. I'm going to read the question. Is BOEM using FAST 41 or one federal decision process? And if so, is it helping with the NEPA and permitting process for offshore wind? Second part of the question, can you share what's causing the delays for the Vineyard Wind draft EIS as an example?
Sure. Let me answer that. Michelle, you can chime in if you want. The one federal decision process is being used for the Vineyard Wind project. And although the Vineyard Wind project is not the topic of today, the short answer to the question about whether or not that is having an effect, the answer is. I think the simple answer is no. There's a project in the, there's a process or a requirement and a time frame for the one federal decision, which is really a two-year process. For Vineyard Wind, we set up a much more aggressive schedule for our review of that project and the complexities of the issues involved and the timing of things and our essentially first time through this full process led us to a point where the full review cannot occur in the time frame that we had originally set up, but we are indeed still well within the two-year window that was set up by the one federal decision. So we set up an ambitious schedule, and we're still within the time frame that one federal decision has identified. I think it does. I think the process does allow us to have more interaction with other federal agencies and helps us to streamline that process, even though there may be more in the way of substantive issues that we have to deal with. The second part of that question was I can't get into much of the internal. There's a number of different issues that we have to deal with. Obviously, commercial fisheries is one of them. Some of the analysis in the environmental impact statement, particularly the cumulative analysis, these are the things that we're examining and need to work on as we move forward.
Michelle, I think that one important thing to add to that for folks on the phone is neither the Virginia commercial lease nor the North Carolina commercial lease is currently under the FAST 41 process. And Michelle, could you give a little bit of explanation of what that is?
Yeah, so to qualify under one federal decision or FAST 41, there's a few requirements. An EIS, it's been determined an EIS is required. There's multiple authorizations. There's cost of the project. So it looks like all construction and operation plans, commercial scale facilities, will automatically fall under the one federal decision process. In addition, developers can request to be a covered project under FAST 41. There's a lot of similarities between the two, including the two-year time frame that Jim described. So what the one federal decision process sets up is one environmental impact statement, one record of decision, rather than each federal agency preparing their separate environmental reviews. So, and there's a lot of coordination points and concurrence points. So it does make the process more efficient. That's the goal.
Okay. Eileen, we will speak with you during the public session. All right, that closes out all of the open comments, I believe, that we had in the chat box. Just to confirm, we have a few minutes available for the task force if there are any other open items. I know I, for one, would like to make sure we give, if available, we heard earlier with both Avangrid and Dominion, their perspective from the side of their communication and DOD compliance in multiple different situations as far as ongoing surveys and UXO multi-year programs. And it would be good if there were any lessons learned from the Navy or the Coast Guard in communications. We think that is kind of the cornerstone of when folks are out operating in the shared realm, an important element. And so I know Jim Casey and I have talked in the past about this, but if there's anything that can be done better or things that we had acknowledged worked well, that would be good to hear from others than the developers.
Casey, this is Jim Casey here in Norfolk with the Navy. Actually, no, I don't have much to add. Everything so far has seemed to be coordinated fairly well. I think Craig hit it in his presentation. Coordination and early correspondence, early and often, is the key here, in particular when we're trying to deconflict and ensure that schedules for both industry and for military activities are in fact deconflicted. So, I really don't have anything to add. It's just that early coordination is the key, and reach out to the Navy either to me or to our scheduling agency out at Oceana that owns all the air and sea space activities and scheduling activities. Feel free to reach out to them because they're always willing to ensure that that everybody's needs are addressed and that they try to get everything scheduled properly.
All right, thank you for that. It's amazing how many times in public situations, but myself, I can only speak for personally, we are asked if we coordinate with the Navy off the coast of the largest Navy base in the world when we look at conditions and activities on our leases. So thanks for that, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, we'll open it up again to the group. And if there are no comments, at this time, I think we hope. Michael, if you're on and available to open up mic. I see you typing in the chat box, so we'll give him a second. Okay, I think we'll take a break at this time, and we will meet back up again to cover public comments and give an opportunity for input to the task force. At that time, we'll open back up with a few ground rules for that engagement. But thank you, everyone, for their time and participating today.
And we'll reconvene at...
We'll reconvene at 12. The task force, of course, goes until 12:50, but we are going to allow for public input to the task force from 12 to 12:20. So it is requested that task force members stay on the call until 12:50 today so that we can reflect on any comments that the public may have.
And when we reconvene at 12, we'll have Carol, the operator, give instructions on how to get into for the public members of how to get into the queue so you can get an open mic. So we will reconvene back here at 12 o'clock, which is roughly 5 minutes. break, but we've got us back on schedule to ensure we're in alignment with the public information session. So just a little bit for this session, we do run the task forces under an exemption to FACA, which is why you see the membership essentially down to federal agencies, elected tribal governments, elected local officials, and elected state officials, i.e. the governor or their designated representatives, which are usually the state agencies. But public input is important, so that's why we kind of integrate this into the meeting. So in this session, we'll in a moment when I hand it over for instructions for how to get in the queue. We don't do a direct answer of questions, but we are looking for kind of any input or insights or feedback you have. Once this session concludes, we'll start back up with the task force meeting, where based upon what we heard, we'll offer an opportunity for task force members to kind of provide any insights or reflections based upon what they heard from the public. So with that, I will hand it over to Carol to provide instructions to the public for how to get into the queue.
Thank you. At this time, we'll begin for public comments. If you'd like to make a comment, you may press star 1 on your phone. Make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name to introduce that comment. Again, that is star 1 for a comment at this time, and it is star 2 to withdraw that request. And we'll stand by for any public comments at this time. One moment, please. One moment. And we do have a question or comment coming from Eileen Wolf, and please state your company name.
Sierra Club.
Your line is open. Please go ahead with your comment.
Sure. Thank you. I might be splitting hairs here a little bit, but there was a slide that showed the project dates for all the Atlantic projects, and yeah, Bonehead Dominion's commercial lease area as 2025. I'm just wondering how BOEM arrived at that date, because Dominion's been talking now about that first phase coming online in 2024. Like I said, I think might be splitting hairs there, but I would like to know how that 2025 date arrived.
That 2025 date is just an estimate. I would defer to Dominion's estimate, and these estimates do change over time, but I'm not sure that I don't know what the level of accuracy of either one of them would be. We'll see as we get a little bit closer, but again, I would defer to Dominion's estimate of when they think the project will be coming online.
Does that conclude the comment at this time?
For me, yes. Thank you.
My other question,
I think I need to pose directly to Dominion, but I put that in the chat box.
Thank you, Eileen, for participating. We have another question in the chat box to review, and that is from Michael Flynn. When the siting of the location of the transmission cables and substations on land occur? And I think I'll take that one. The design of the projects, including the project easement to shore that BOEM issues, occurs at the COP stage. So the design and the locations of the proposed transmission would be included in a construction and operation plan, and that would undergo an environmental and technical analysis, and alternatives could be considered at that point. But a final project easement, which includes the offshore, any offshore substations or offshore transmission lines to the project, would be completed at the construction and operation plan approval. So, no
don't know if there's any follow-up on that, but that answers that question, hopefully. You're welcome, Mike.
And I'm currently showing no further comments from the phones. Again, as a reminder, if you have a comment from the phones, you may press star 1. Make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name to introduce that comment. And you may press star 2 to withdraw that request. Again, for comments from the phones, press star 1 and record your name at this time. And I'll stand by for any further comments.
And just so folks on the phone are aware, this is Casey with Boehm. Again, we are committed to staying open until 20 after to make sure anyone calling in during that period, we've made ourselves available for their comments.
And I'm currently showing no comments at this time. Again, as a reminder, that is star 1 and record your name and star 2 to withdraw that request. And I will stand by for any further comments at this time. One moment. And we do have another comment from Eileen Wolf, and your line is open.
Yeah, sorry. The North Carolina project, it's coming, the cables are coming onshore in Virginia. I thought I saw that on a map, but then I didn't screen capture it, so I can't go back to it.
This is Will. I mean, what we can tell you right now, what you saw today is where Avangrid is undergoing its survey efforts, looking for locations. So, for example, if I go back to that slide. So you can see they're obviously surveying their lease area, and they're surveying a potential cable route. But I kind of stress that it's potential. They could do survey work there and realize maybe they need to go somewhere else. There could be something that comes up for them that they choose to go to look for a different interconnection point. But ultimately, I think as you've heard today, is we won't really know where they're proposing to go till later in the process when they submit a construction and operations plan. They're really kind of in the assessment or exploratory stage in terms of trying to collect data to figure out what is best for the infrastructure and development of their project.
Can I ask another question? The construction and operations plan, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's been no approved construction and operations plans yet by Boehm for any projects in the Atlantic. And then sort of as I saw that you had for Dominion, the construction and operations plan, the COP should be due in April 2022. So I'm just wondering if what you anticipate would be the process for that, how long that would take if Dominion filed it April 2022. I mean, I know if the SAP is any indication, you know, that took like 2.5 years to finally get approved. If you're anticipating that COPs would equally take that type of length of time for complete review.
Eileen, I think that all of these processes are years-long processes, and it's dependent on the activities and the stakeholder and activities that are occurring in 2022 when a COP does come in, because the situation offshore is dynamic, but Boehm follows a a consistent process reviewing the plans. There is quite a bit of information to support plans off of Virginia already, but the final siting and the alternatives that will need to be developed by Dominion can't really be speculated on. So as their project comes to the point of a construction operation plan being delivered, we attempt to maintain our due diligence in reviewing that, but giving you exact timelines is an impossibility. Jim, do you have?
I think we need to keep in mind two things. One is that each project is unique, and the other one is that the we're still learning in this process. We haven't done a lot of COP reviews. We're going to be getting more and more in, and as we execute the review of the construction operations plan, we're going to learn from that process, and we're going to be able to apply that, and hopefully as the plans, as we review more plans down the road, we'll be more and more efficient and expeditious about getting them reviewed. But we have to make sure that we do it right.
Does that conclude the comments at this time?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. And again, as a reminder, if you do have a comment, it is star one. Make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name to introduce that comment. And to withdraw that, you may press star two. Once again, for a comment from the phones, press star one and record your name, and it is star two to withdraw that request. And I'll stand by for further comments.
Okay. Well, we have a question about whether there has been any discussion about compensating commercial fishermen. Certainly, that is an issue that has come up, but the discussion of the identification of that kind of mitigation as part of the NEPA process, the environmental impact statement, and the identification of impacts and mitigation that might be associated with that impact, those impacts. So, as an issue, it certainly has come up, but we don't have any decisions to share at this point in time.
And again, as a reminder, for comments from the phones, press star one and record your name, and it is star two to withdraw that request. Again, for further comments, press star one at this time. Standing by for any comments. And I'm currently showing no comments from the phones. Again, as a reminder, it's star one and record your name and star two to withdraw that request. And standing by for any comments. Again, as a reminder, for any comments from the phones, it is star one and record your name and star two to withdraw that request. And we are standing by. And again, I'm showing no comments at this time. As a reminder, it is star 1. Make sure your phone is unmuted and record your comment or your name for to your comment. And you may press star 2 to withdraw that request. Again, for further comments, press star 1 and record your name at this time. And we're standing by for any comments.
So there's a question in Europe, offshore wind farms tend to follow DNV best practices regarding insulation protection of seabed power cables. What are BOEM's requirements? BOEM's regulations require that where cables can be buried, that they are buried to a depth of 2 meters. We require a facility design report and fabrication and installation report after approval of a COP. In that fabrication and installation report, the developer outlines the process that they will go through to install any transmission or inter-array cables associated with the project. We also mandate that our within our regs that best practices, best engineering practices are followed in the design and installation of offshore wind facilities. We have a each developer with along with its project proposal submits a nomination for a certified verification agent that determines in association with BOEM, what best practices will be followed in the design and installation facilities overall, and that includes the transmission and inter-array cable as part of the project.
Have any follow-ups to that? That was a response to the chat. Yeah, Ian?
And again, for any comments from the phones, it is star 1. Make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name to introduce that comment. And to withdraw that request, you may press star 2. Once again, that's star 1. And we'll stand by for any further comments. And again, as a reminder, for any additional comments at this time, press star 1, record your name, and it is star 2 to withdraw that request. Again, for further comments, press star 1 at this time, and we're standing by for any comments. And I'm still showing no further comments at this time. And again, as a reminder, if you have any comments, it is star 1 and record your name, and it is star 2 to withdraw that request. Again, for additional comments, press star 1 and record your name at this time. And we're standing by for any additional comments.
All right, we will take one more sweep in the next 30 seconds to make sure any public participants that have any questions get those in front of the task force.
And again, as a reminder, that is star 1 for a comment and record your name, and star 2 to withdraw that request. And we are standing by.
All right, moving on to the final leg of the agenda. For those who have joined us today and who are still on the line, this session is open back again to only discussion between task force members. And this is the point in the agenda where task force members have the opportunity to discuss or ruminate on any other topics brought up by the public during the previous session. We also have the opportunity during this time, if any other topics for discussion important to task force members need to be discussed, we have an open format. We certainly do not want to extend a meeting if it has reached its clear conclusion, but if there are topics on the table that any task force member believes is important to them, then they are important to us, and we're here to discuss.
Casey, this is Jennifer Munt, North Carolina. I have a quick question for y'all at Bellum.
Sure.
Thanks. I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit more to the path forward as y'all are evaluating the potential areas in the OCS for further evaluation and development. What kind of, recognizing that y'all have a lot on your plate right now, what kind of time frame are you looking at, and how can the states be partners with you as you move forward? Thank you.
Jennifer, thanks for the question. We do appreciate your participation in the Path Forward effort. In terms of information that is most useful to us, what we've identified through that effort is, in general, the areas that might be more suitable for development. But we do need much more in the way of input from the state. Even though you have expressed the desire, both Virginia and North Carolina have expressed the desire to explore more areas, and we're very much looking forward to doing that with you. We could definitely use more information from the state as to where they think, given the various concerns of navigation and fisheries, et cetera, might be worth looking into in more detail. Having said that, we're also looking to industry to provide similar information, because although we are told that we are interested in more areas, and we are told in many instances that we have great demand and targets that we want to fulfill for offshore wind, we don't always get specifics as to where we could go forward, either in terms of specific geographic areas or areas that are that we should stay away from, or that there are showstoppers that wind energy is deemed not to be compatible. So we're very open to input from the state to move forward on that front.
Yeah, and Jennifer, this is Casey. Just to add to that, I think the intent of today was to provide a framework for a continuous update to the task forces and the broader topic and discussion of additional areas leads to a more specific task force meeting with the members of the task force with the information that Jim mentioned potentially in the future as those items are checked and information is compiled.
Will and Casey, this is John Stanton, Fish and Wildlife, North Carolina task member. I want to thank you guys for this update, and I'd love to encourage BOEM to consider updates as warranted. I think this process, you know, is a long haul, and I think we get very active around certain decision points and process points, but then we go inactive for a while. So I'd just like to impress upon the task force that we meet as frequently as we need to. When changes are pending or new processes are going to be introduced, we move from one phase to another. I very much appreciate the forum, you know, web-based or conference call, so I encourage those opportunities to be made available as frequently as we can possibly sustain. And I think we're getting ready to, you know, transition here from the leasing more into an active role of the site assessment report approval, and then the, you know, the cops rolling out the door. So pretty exciting times, but also the need for communication maybe ramps up. So just a point of recommendation there. And then as a topic item maybe for future updates, I myself, and maybe it's just me on the task force, but I would appreciate an overview of this one federal decision process. Maybe from the way you see it as the administrators of the offshore leasing, what that looks like in practice for the benefit of the task force members, or, so that we can align our engagement to kind of make that process as efficient as it can be. So if you see that as a topic that has bearing or importance, I would welcome kind of a one federal decision discussion process and maybe vetting for all the task force members.
Okay, thank you. We'll keep that in mind for the next telecon or meeting that we have.
Yeah, and thanks for your input. We do try to value everyone's time that participates in these and make sure that when we do meet, it is meaningful and we have updates. We definitely, the timing issue is something that is constantly trying to be balanced, and when is too much information and what information task force members would like to see. So
I appreciate that. And, you know, I know the coordination organization of these is no simple task. So if we can, you know, as a task force accept, you know, updates that are, you know, narrative, electronic, without the need to kind of get on a conference call and maybe present them very formally. If you are comfortable with sharing bulleted updates on process and procedure, I would welcome that as a committee member. So kind of a little bit less prep in that delivery of that format as opposed to, you know, pulling together formal, quote-unquote, facilitated with you know, call services and call-in. So if you consider that to updates and electronically to the task force, that's very much appreciated too.
Thanks, John.
This is Will. Just follow up for you, John. You should now have a list of the folks who were in attendance regarding the high-definition video surveys that are being conducted by Avangrid.
Yeah, thank you for that. And Craig reached out to me, too, on the November call that I was unable to attend. So thank you.
All right. Again, I can't thank you guys enough for participating in this session today. This is Casey again, and we are going to end early and give folks back a couple minutes during lunch. With that, I will turn it over to
let me ask if Jennifer or Angela have any closing comments that they'd like to make before we wrap up.
This is Angela. I just want to say thank you to everybody for joining today. Thanks for giving us the opportunity to provide some updates on the status in Virginia, and we look forward to continuing these conversations.
Angela, you have anything to say? Well, I just have a. Yeah, I'm sorry. Oh, that was Angela. I'm sorry, Angela. If Jennifer, if you're on the line, anything you want to remark with regard to our closing here? If not, let me note just a couple of things. First, again, is a thank you for your participation. I hope that this session has proved illuminating on the work that we're doing in Virginia and North Carolina. And I hope you feel that there's a good avenue here for continuing the communication, as was suggested by John just a few minutes ago. There is one thing that I didn't mention when we spoke earlier, and it was touched on a couple of times throughout the course of the meeting, and that is that just like we are or should be doing in terms of supply chain, we are taking, as you know, more of a regional approach, which is why this task force meeting is a combined Virginia and North Carolina, because of both the geographic and the economic and the policy concerns in the area. So we appreciate your working with us in this forum because we think it'll work better over the long term. As far as the meeting goes, I want to note that I think we're hearing that very substantial progress is being made on several fronts with these projects, but not only in terms of the projects themselves, but in terms of the research efforts and the research design that is needed to gather the appropriate information. Finally, I want to note that as far as the desire to add more areas, which we're certainly receptive to, we need your input. We need not only, of course, identification of specific areas that we think we want to move forward with, but also what your greatest concerns are, anything in terms of showstoppers or the like that can help us further define what areas we should identify for further leasing. So with that, again, thank you for your participation, and we'll look forward to working with you in the months ahead.
Thank you.
We'll conclude this task force meeting. Thank you, everyone, for your participation.
Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.